This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books, publishing, and the future. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Justo Hidalgo. He is the founder of 24 Symbols, which is a subscription e-reading platform based in Madrid. How are you, Justo?
Hello, David. How are you? Nice to be here.
Thank you for doing this. Are you at work now or are you relaxing?
Oh, no. I'm at work right now. It's along with my colleagues. So, you know, in a startup, you work full day.
That is true. And now 24 Symbols has been going for several years. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the history and what it was that prompted you to give up your entire life and put everything into fulfilling the dream of building an ebook subscription business.
Yeah, it'd be a pleasure. So, yeah, the company was founded in 2010, so it's 5 years already, and it was founded by four people that we worked together in a tech company. And the reason we started with this is that we wanted to do something related to ebooks. At the beginning, we were thinking about doing some publishing business, a moonlighting project, but then we realized that, we wouldn't be good publishers. And then this idea of one of my colleagues came in one coffee conversation about, you know, is there any Spotify for books? Because at that time in Spain, 2010, is when Spotify was coming up very strongly. Everyone was using Spotify. So this idea came about subscription service for ebooks, and then we started to talk to some publishers we knew of, and then we started to read, and we saw that there was nothing really, there was no horizontal service. Of course, there was Safari for technical books, but nothing really horizontal. But there were lots of conversations about that, for good, for bad. There were some people who were convinced, some people who thought it was impossible, it was a mixture of technology and culture that we really enjoyed. And then I would say the highlight that prompted us into doing it is when the iPad was introduced by Steve Jobs in the end of January in 2010. That's when we saw there was a huge opportunity. We knew how to create an international product, and because of our experience. And then, you know, we started working on that and until now.
Well, and you referred to your experience. Is your background and experience in technology?
Yeah. The four founders come from a technical background, meaning, you know, computer science or electrical engineering. But basically, the thing is that the four founders had different experience. So, for example, our current CTO, he came from the technical background. And he was still there while some others just moved into the marketing or sales, but always in like technical or tech-related companies. In my specific case, I did a mixture. I'm a computer science engineer, but at the same time, I had a PhD in data science. But I also worked in business and marketing. So we all together, you know, kind of balanced ourselves in creating a good team, and then we joined, and we found our first investors came from the publishing and media industry, which was also very useful in terms of understanding the needs and the possibilities in 24 Symbols.
So now you've been doing this for 5 years, and there are obviously other companies that have joined you in the subscription model based in the U.S. Mm-hmm. We have Oyster, and then there's Scribd, and those are probably the two biggest and best known. We also have Epic for children's books, and a smaller company called Farfaria. And all of them work on a similar model. I assume 24 Symbols does as well, where a reader, a subscriber, pays a fee for a period of time. Maybe it's a month or whatever, or maybe it's a week, but the period that you pay on is enabling you to have access to the content on the site during the period of your subscription. And maybe you could talk a little bit about how your subscription model works for the reader, and then we can ask, and I can talk to you a little bit about how it works for the publisher side.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you've defined it very well. In our case, it's a subscription service for users, for readers, where they can register for free and have access to the social network that we create. That's something that is really important for us. We want users to become digital librarians so that we enable them to create virtual bookshelves from scratch and then start sharing the bookshelves they create with the books they find in 24 Symbols with their friends, and then people can follow other people or other bookshelves and then create kind of a, again, a social network where people can talk, but not only talk, but also read, the books that they like. And then, of course, there's free people can read up to 10% of each book. It's like a sample reading, as you can find in other retailers. And then, of course, if you want to read whatever you want, however you want, then you can pay a monthly fee. As you said, this, for example, in the US, it's $99 a month, where you can read whatever you want, and then you can read offline. But again, I think our main differentiator beyond, you know, what we believe is quality of the apps and things like that is the approach that we take into making everything a social experience. We believe that, you know, of course, people can read by themselves and, you know, many people decide to do that. But we believe that when books become digital, there are many other options that people can do around books.
Right. And so, I mean, that is an interesting differentiator, as you said. So just let's explore a little bit some of the things that either you do now or you want to do in the future, and also how you see your readers, since you have access to it, how they're using the platform. You know, I'm really interested in how readers share and what it is that they share. Do people talk about, you know, as they do with Goodreads or on Amazon, say, here's a book I read, I recommend it to you. That's sort of the basic modality of sharing, but what about within the reading experience? In other words, and this is something I know that Bob Stein from the Institute of the Future of the Book is interested in, and that is social sharing within the reading experience, so that if I'm reading a book and you're reading the book at the same time, we can talk about it together inside of some social sphere. And is that something that you enable, and is that something you see as valuable?
Yeah, no, we definitely see it as valuable. The main difference, and you know, I think that the example of social book is a great example, is that since we provide a commercial service, we have to be careful about which information can be shared or not. So that's something we're currently working on. Actually, it's part of one of the projects we're, you know, right now into development. Because right now, you know, people can share the books they like and comment on the books they like in a public way. But as you mentioned, we believe that the interest here lies in people talking inside of the book and becoming the marginalia, the new kind of marginalia that is part of what I believe is the future of ebooks here. We're into that. So we're being pretty careful about how people can share what they want out of a book, which can be part of a group. For example, in terms of education, where a teacher can create a group, a reading group inside of a book, and then that information will only be available for that or something more public. But we believe this is part of the feature of the book, and that's where we're going.
And does that also, I guess, another application would be just a private individual, a private group, you know, where people here in America, I don't know whether this is true in Europe as much, but here there are thousands of reading groups where people get together. You know, it might be informal. They might just be a bunch of people who are friends and they like to get together and in the physical space, you know, they'll read a book together, talk about it in social settings. And I could imagine, therefore, in a subscription model, if everyone in the group subscribed, they could continue to read the book both physically or digitally. It doesn't really matter, but they could expand the social communication to occur across distance. So you wouldn't have to necessarily be meeting together weekly to talk about the book. You could, you know, if you found a passage that you found remarkably wonderful, you could instantly bookmark it essentially and share it with everybody inside your group.
Or even if you still meet physically, you can extend, as you said, the discussion beyond the limits of, you know, the weekly meeting that you have. You know, so that's clearly part of the discussion. The only thing in our case is that, of course, we need to manage a roadmap, and there's some things we can do and some things we, you know, we don't have time. But for example, in terms of education, it's something we see as clear. And we believe that, you know, students, and we can add book clubs to this student, meaning, you know, understanding the meaning of the book. That's part of what we want to build during this year, for sure.
Right. And do you see, I mean, this is always the question that I think people ask, and that is, do readers express that interest in advance of it? Or is this something that once people learn is possible, they become excited about it?
That's a great question. We see both things. In this case, it was something that's been requested many times. Since we started, we provided the option to share comments on the book or about the book, and therefore, you know, the question always came about, you know, what about inside of the book? So in this specific case, something that's been really requested. On the other hand, you know, what people really want as experience, as number one experience, is to read, you know, and that's why during the first years, we were very focused on having a great reader and then having great content. But of course, as you mentioned, you know, you have more competitors, you have more options, you start to diversify, you start to look for, you know, places where people read so you can be there. And this ability to share is something very important for us. And not only, as I said, inside of the book in terms of, you know, you can comment on the book, but this concept of virtual bookshelf that I mentioned before, I believe is quite interesting, because people sometimes don't want to talk about specific books. They want to talk about a genre or you know, a topic. And, you know, enabling that is also quite powerful.
Do you find in that specific case, I mean, this is something I hadn't really thought about in terms of the subscription model, because in that, in, let's say on your platform, you have thousands of books.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I think about reading, I think about the books that I have either in my possession physically or digitally. And then if, as you just said, someone refers to a book as part of a conversation, I might go look that book up. And if it's on Google Books, you know, I could sample it online. Or if it's on Amazon, I could look at the very beginning of the book, or Barnes and Noble, you know, any of the online sites where look inside the book is enabled, you can do a little bit of looking. But I, you know, hadn't really thought about if some sort of a conversation, somebody brought up, let's say, an obscure book that I probably don't own, and then there's something in that book they wanted me to read, not necessarily to read the whole thing, but here's a scene or here's a character that, you know, I was reading book A and it spurred me to think about book B. In the subscription platform where all of those books exist, it would be easy for me to respond to you saying, go look at book B. I could then just go and sample that book in a much more comprehensive way because I can really look through it. I just hadn't really thought of that as being a possibility. And so that's really what you're talking about there, in the sense of conversation about books, not just, you know, talking about a specific book, but talking about books as contextual.
Absolutely, and this was part of our vision from day one, and that's imagine something that doesn't exist yet, of course, but imagine that this is part of the conversation, as you said, so you could go from one book to another, from one passage to another, and, you know, the conversation would go from book to book. Just stealing one of the, let's say, buzzwords that the great product for me, Small Demons, did, is kind of creating a storyverse. Where conversations around books just go together. You can jump from one book to another and the conversation continues. Very similar when you are, you know, with your friends speaking about, you know, books or movies or songs, and you go from one to another. But, you know, you just don't talk about them. You can just be inside of them.
Yeah, that is really interesting. So just thinking about how you would communicate that in a kind of compelling way to readers, because it isn't something that we as readers have experienced before. You know, you're talking about what digital can enable us to do that we have not been able to do in physical book form. And, you know, I think there's this kind of sense in the publishing business, and I'm not sure that this is, I agree with this, but that at least the initial stage of developing ebooks has made, it's gone as far as it knows how to, or it's kind of reached a plateau. People talk about, you know, the either the plateauing of sales or the lack mm-hmm. of growth. And I think the sense I would draw from that is that readers are getting what they want from the existing technology, but that they have not been offered necessarily what one might call the affordances, the full affordances of software and hardware, or another level of those opportunities for sharing or reading or experiencing books. And I guess what mm-hmm. it feels like what you're saying is this, you know, your platform enables people to do things that they might not have thought of before.
And I'm not just my platform. I don't want to focus just on what 24 Symbols can do. I think that's the next step. So I think your point is very valid. I mean, there's a plateau right now on the sales books. I think that's temporary. I think there's going to be a growth, but of course we will have to wait for the next two years. But I think this is just the first stage. As you said, ebooks basically right now are basically a representation of what print books have been for many years. And one of the points I'm really, really interested is how, since books are textual content, how that text can be processed in order to provide additional services or additional products to the readers that can be really useful. I'm not talking about taking the books away from the user. So, you know, it's about making the books even more attractive to a user that is in this economy of attention. You know, there are many other options that, you know, a digital user can use their time for. So I always said in the last, you know, since we started, that our competition is not Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Scribd or Oyster. It's Angry Birds. You know, is the ability for someone to say, you know, instead of playing Angry Birds, I want to read a book on my digital device. So we have to find ways for books to become more attractive, even more attractive, I would say, to a new type of audience. And I don't say that's easy. I'm not saying that's easy. I think that's going to be very complicated. There are going to be many attempts, both from big publishers or big companies and smaller startups that are going to fail. But I think that's the only way to continue advancing, or one of the important ways to continue advancing what ebooks are and what they can be for, you know, for, and what they can do for the culture in the following years.
Yeah, no, I agree with you on that. I think, you know, what I think about, and of course, everyone draws conclusions from their own behavior, which I think is not very useful. But, you know, the when you talked about the iPad being the spur to get you mm-hmm. to start your business, and what I, you know, what we see now 5 years later, it's not just the iPad, but there are, you know, all these other tablets in use, and people, consumers who use tablets, I mean, I think it's fairly observable as you watch people use them. They're using them for a variety of consumption. And a great deal of that is, I think, casual entertainment. And whether it could be video, it could be video games, but I also think that the amount of time that people spend on social media is really a huge draw away from reading. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you're looking at the tablet and you have all of those apps to choose from, and one of them might be a reading app or two or three or four, you know, you could have four or five different reading apps. What is it that's going to get people to go to the reading app when they say, I've only got 10 minutes, you know, I've only got 15 minutes. I'm not going to sit here for 4 hours looking at my tablet. I'm going to look at it 10 minutes at a time. And it would be, I think, obviously, there are people studying the daily use of devices. I assume that's something you have to pay attention to, you know, the larger context within which you work. And it's not just tablets, it would be phones as well. You know, what do people use them for? How do they use them? How can you interrupt their attention flow? And I think the attention economy is really the critical matter, because they're not necessarily, they've already bought the app, they're already paying for whatever services they get, on the platform. So it's really a matter of what is the thing that's going to make me feel good right now on my device. And, you know, maybe I'm sitting in the subway, or maybe I'm I've got 10 minutes before a class, whatever it is, people dip in. And what you really want to figure out is how can we get them to dip into reading?
No, and that's the big, I think, the big challenge. But I don't say, I'm not saying we're going to find the answer. At the end of the day, the reader or the user in this case can do whatever she wants. So if she wants to play Angry Birds, she's going to do that. The only thing is how to, and another thing is that content is still going to be king. At the end of the day, you know, whatever we do in terms of providing new services for our apps or services, you know, the content is the really important thing here. What we can do is we can try to understand the needs of the user as much as we can based on their behavior, based on what they use on their apps and on their devices, in order to make their decisions easier, in order to, you know, maybe this is the time you should read this book, or you should read this, you know, chapter or whatever. This is where I believe we have choices of making the reading service more attractive. But it's going to take time. I mean, it's not. I don't have the answer now, and I don't think we're going to have it for a few years. It's just, you know, try and have mistakes and continue going.
So do you see, when you think about subscription, which obviously you do all the time, you know, one way of pursuing that model is to say we have to have as much content as possible because people need choices when they've subscribed. You really, they want to choose as much as from as large a set of content as possible. Or I could see another approach, which would be to say, well, no matter how much content we have, and it could be hundreds of thousands of books, it could be millions of books, readers will still need assistance in making decisions, because if you have 12 million books to choose from and you're only going to read one book at a time, how do you choose what to read? So for you, I mean, you have the same issues that a retailer does. You know, you're a retailer, in the sense of, you know, I guess the question is, how do you think about the way that consumers need to interact with content choice on your platform? And again, you're also operating within the larger context that they have virtually unlimited choice of things to do, as you said, Angry Birds, but it could also be, as you said before, Spotify or YouTube, where, you know, on YouTube, I can't even count the number of videos that you could choose to watch at any given moment. So how do you think about choice and quantity and curation, not just for 24 Symbols, but kind of, you know, as the more, you know, as the kind of the challenge for the retailer in the digital environment? How do you think about that?
No, that's a great question, David. And I think it's a parallel way, at least in our experience. Of course, any service providing content needs a minimum amount of content to work. And if it's a vertical niche, then you need at least, you know, the most important, or, you know, a minimum set of things that make the user say, well, when it's good enough for me, I search or I browse the service, and I find at least a minimum of what I want to consume. That's a minimum. And in the first 2-3 years of our time, you know, in 24 Symbols, what we did was to try to find as much content as possible. But then, of course, there comes a moment where, you know, you might not have everything that, you know, is available, but there's so much information there that you have the risk of, as you said, making your user crazy, you know, trying to find, you know, I don't know if you have what I need. I don't know if what you have is interesting to me. And then, you keep on going in parallel. You need to keep on doing content acquisition. In our case, keep talking to publishers. But then you need to think about other areas. And in our case, you know, we started with the average things. You know, we had a search engine. We had a categorization system, things like that. But then is when we started to think about other ways to provide that. And I'll give you just a very simple, quick example. The way we've evolved as a company is that, of course, when we started, we're basically a tech company. But then you start to realize that you need to provide some human curation to everything that you do. So, of course, we were pretty good at, you know, algorithms of recommendation for books and things like that. And then you realize that that's very important, and that's the base of it all. But at the end of the day, you need to take a look at the users and see, okay, maybe, you know, as a librarian, as you know, as a digital librarian, as the team we have here, you start to think about what are the, for example, the virtual bookshops that we're going to create so that people can enjoy them. Or these are the books that we believe you're going to like. And it's not because an algorithm tells us, it's because the algorithm sets the base and we as humans decide what to do in our platform. And I think that's the way to do it. It's what we call hybrid curation. It's a hybrid between what the technologies can provide, what are the best recommendation engine we can build based on all the information about reader behavior we have, but then we need to mix that up with, you know, with people that knows about books, that have been working in books for years and can make this quality switch and provide our readers what they really want to do, what they really want to read. I'm sorry.
So let me, I want to kind of switch to another line of questioning for you.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, when you, you know, you're obviously, you have to, as a business, talk to publishers. They're the ones who have the content, as you mentioned before. You know, the content is the core value. So when you talk to publishers, do you find, what as of now, which is, you know, the middle of 2015, what are the things that you find interesting about how publishers are thinking about their content and their digital futures? And, you know, when you talk to publishers, what kinds of concerns do they have? You know, you're in a position where, because you're talking to publishers who own this content, I would think you know a lot about what they're thinking.
Well, I'm not sure if I know a lot. No, but we've obviously seen a change, or you know, of how things were since we started. You know, take into account that when we started in 2010, when most publishers, basically, we were thinking about how to digitize their books, and we were talking about a subscription service for ebooks. So it was kind of crazy for them to, you know, it was very difficult for us to establish an honest conversation with them, because, you know, we were talking about things that started to be important a few years later. What we've seen in the last year and a half is a big change in terms of how they feel about new business models, specifically subscription services, but also other subscription services. And for me, the big change was, you know, in 2014, we went from, I think it was like 110 publishers after 2 years, 3 years working, to more than 600 publishers in 3 months, just because, you know, suddenly everyone started to understand that this was another way that maybe publishing could work, just an additional revenue channel. My main concern than talking to publishers is still one of the main concerns I see is this mixed approach to how they work with Amazon, to be completely honest. And this, on the one hand, this fear of working with a big giant that is quite explicit about their midterm goals. But on the other hand, disabling any additional competition from smaller companies like ours or others, just because of that fear of making the giant angry. And this is something that I believe is part of our continuous conversation with them. And I think that's part of what they should really think about, you know, is thinking more in the midterm about what types of retailers and other stakeholders they want to have in the future of the publishing industry. Require some actions on their side now, because if not, in 2 years, we're going to be in the same situation as now, or even worse. And the smaller retailers are not going to be there to help them.
Yeah, I think that has to be a major concern. Is that we want to have a healthy ecosystem, and a healthy ecosystem is one that has diversity and enough opportunity, so that you're not, you as a publisher are not limited in your choices. You know, obviously, every publisher has to exist within physical constraints, you know, of the delivery system and the competition. And, you know, there always are limitations, but you want to have as much choice as possible and not be put in a position where your business model is dictated for you all the time.
Yeah, and I put myself on their shoes, and I understand some of the decisions they have to make, because at the end of the day, they have to make a living. But especially with, you know, the mid-size and big-size publishers, they, I think they need, you know, some of them are doing. I mean, and as I said, there's been a big change in the last year and a half, but I think, you know, sometimes past some of the conversations we still have are kind of, from our standpoint, is quite short-sighted in terms of, you know, the things that will happen in the following years.
Do you think publishers feel, as I do, I'm not sure what you think about this, but do publishers feel that the mobile, the expansion of mobile technology and the ubiquity of smartphones and increasingly of tablets means that reading will be taking place differently? You know, as we were talking about before, this sort of social and kind of occasional reading seems to me enabled by the technology, and that we have not yet figured out the best way to engage readers. But I think that I don't think that's impossible. I think that the technology and the software are catching up, or the software is catching up to the technology, is how I would look at it, and that user behavior will evolve or continue to evolve. But do publishers, do you feel that publishers are thinking that way or not?
Oh, in that case, I think they are. I mean, even I remember when we started in this industry since 2010. I remember going to one of the, I don't remember the name, it changed to Digital Minds later, but the event just before London Book Fair in 2011, and there were already, you know, publishers working on enhanced books and you know, trying to find you know, new ways of making use of the technology and the software that was available, and how to engage new readers. So I believe that you know, is part of what we were talking at the beginning. I think that's part of the of life in publishing from now on. I mean, they have to spend money in experimenting, in trying new things, and some of them will work, some of them will not stick, and continue there. We were just here in the office, we were just talking about company that is doing audio and ebook synchronization, so that, you know, you can switch from audio to ebook just whenever you want, you know, and that's another part of the story here, you know, is making the most of the different media assets that you have in order to create a compelling user experience.
So
I wouldn't say reader listener experience.
Right. So and you're because you have so much access to behavioral data about how people are reading and how they're interacting with content, are you able to draw from that at this point? And maybe, I'm not sure you can, but I'm just interested if you can draw from that knowledge base a prediction or a suggestion for publishers about how their content could be shaped to be attractive to readers. And I say that kind of knowing that some people might react negatively to that concept, but I think that it's just sort of like people make choices about the book design. You know, when you're talking about a physical book, we choose how to present the content to make it as attractive as possible to readers. I would assume that would also be true in a digital environment. And because you have access to so much data, theoretically, it seems to me you would be able to draw conclusions or at least suggestions from that data that would say to a publisher, here's what you could do to make that content more compelling in the way it's presented to a reader. Do you feel that that's possible?
That's definitely possible, but it's really hard. And I say that with knowledge. I mean, my background is in that data science. My PhD is in data science, so I you know, and we have people here in the team that, you know, work on that. There's processing the data first is difficult, and then finding the results, checking that the results you have from different forecasting techniques and algorithms, whether they are true or false or good or bad is something even more difficult. But we're, you know, we believe that's part of this, and we're really working on that. And actually, there's a project that we are, you know, prioritizing right now. But, you know, we say, okay, it's going to be an important part of our work for 2016 about how to make the most of exactly what you just said. I mean, making the most of the reading behavior in order to provide information to publishers, of course, in an aggregated way, there's a data protection law that we all need to be aware of, but that allows publishers and distributors and even their readers themselves to now understand more about, you know, what other potential books or content or genres or whatever they can use. And, you know, there's still a lot of work there going on, but if you take a look at the, you know, real projects that are the academic and commercial projects, every single step is really hard because it's based on, again, processing massive amounts of data and just a single mistake can may cause you, you know, going into the right, into the wrong direction. So we're being very careful there, but, you know, I personally think that's part, a huge part of the future of publishing and media as a whole.
That's right, is to use the data to draw conclusions and direction about how to work.
Yes, as this is not mine. This is many people say this. It's being data informed, not data driven. I mean, I think, especially publishing, that needs to be driven by other parameters. But you need to be data informed, and right now, there's a huge opportunity to be data informed. But having said this, it's not as easy as, you know, making a few formulas on Excel to just get results. You need to do many things. You need to code a lot of programs and make a lot of assumptions. And especially, you need to validate with publishers, with users, with readers, whether what you're doing makes sense or not. And that's going to take time. But it's really a huge part of publishing, in my opinion.
No, I think that's really, I think that's an important observation. Well,
yeah, and just if I may add just one thing, because this is one thing I really like. That requires, I remember a few years ago, lots of conversations in publishing events about, you know, how publishers needed to have developers and how that was a big change in terms of, you know, the type of role they may play inside of a publishing house and of course, the salaries and all that stuff. And I think now it's the same thing with data scientists or, you know, at least data experts. You're going to need to have either people inside that help you with that or, you know, get help from companies that can understand the data that you provide in order to make sense of that. And that's another, and that's going to be a big part of the challenge.
I think it is a big part of challenge because, you know, every time publishers have to think about a new function, it's both difficult because the function itself might be unfamiliar, but it's also a challenge, as you indicated, because you have to figure out how to pay for it.
Yeah. And it's a total different role. And as you said, different even salary structures. I mean, everything changes. And there are, of course, many options, but they need to make those decisions. You know, we're talking about publishing, but this every single startup, every single organization is becoming data driven. So they need to have those roles in place. And if you don't have it, then you're gonna have in a competitive disadvantage compared to the other people on the road.
I think that's very accurate. Well, I really want to thank you, Justo, for taking the time out of your day. I know you've been busy, this was a great conversation. It was really fun to hear you talk, and I really appreciate the opportunity to hear from you.
Well, it's a real pleasure, David, to be on your program, so thanks so much.
Thank you. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books, publishing, and the future. I'm David Wilk. Today I've been talking to Justo Hidalgo of 24 Symbols, based in Madrid. Thank you.